Well, good morning. It's 11 o'clock here on, the 29th of January. A very brisk last week to 10 days in January, and you're listening to Green Zine at WFERLP South Royalton. Well, you know, I kind of like winter, particularly when there's a lot of snow out there, but spring is just around the corner. Gardeners are out there receiving their seed packets or making some late orders, and we have a seeds story coming up, and also a guest from the Pacific Northwest that we've had on the air before. But let's get started with some music all about seeds from one of my favorite artists who's from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Here's Seeds from May Erlewine on Green Zine, Free Vermont Radio. She appeared, I remember when it was right as COVID was about to hit back in March of 2019. Great artist. She and her former partner formed a collective that also included a record label, and it was called Earthworks, and I think they are still cooking with that label out there. Let's see if our gentleman from the Queen City is cooking this morning. Henry, are you all connected with me here?
Good evening. I am. I have my top hat on, and I'm directing traffic at the Queen City.
Okay. Your top hat, you mean the one that you used to use as the interlocutor?
Yes.
Hey, great. I just had some success.
Calling me a gentleman, I have to.
I guess maybe you don't get that too often. But we have a lot of respect for you here at Royalton Community Radio. Yeah, I was just zipping around in here, and finally, for some reason, the bird note did load. It was being very obstreperous. I think this cold weather, not only did it mess up our entry lock at the bottom of the stairs, which is now operational again due to a regular listener's loan of a de-icing fluid, but pretty cold all around. That is the forecast in the past and the forecast in the future.
Indeed, it's real winter. It's what Vermont is supposed to have rather than what it's been getting.
Yeah, right, right.
Like but, it or not.
But don't let the climate change denier step up and say, see, there's not any global warming. See how cold it is in Vermont? We might hear that from some other sources, but not on this radio show.
Well, that's why we call it climate change instead of global warming.
Yeah, yeah, because it takes...
I mean, actually, I think it's the oil companies that invented that to make it sound less of a problem, but it better describes what happens because the climate is definitely getting more and more radical.
Yeah, lots of rapid changes. One thing that we've noted over the last few years is when we do get a rain event... that it lingers rather than passing through, and maybe, but we've had some real deluges because a lot of these systems seem to slow down and stall, and that definitely causes a lot of problems.
Yes. So I want to give a quick shout out to the break in the music. A lot of those pieces that play between. Echo Shock and our program are things that I dropped into the system years ago.
Yes, you did.
Kind of my favorites. That's a very quirky group, that harmonica playing. That's Seamus and Haney. I don't know if I've ever heard them anywhere except for the one CD that I had. But
I enjoyed that. Now, Henry, just on the subject of music, before we move along and have you mention who our guest is going to be, were you the guy who put those sea shanties in there as well?
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Somebody wants to talk to you about that. There are some unpolitically correct lyrics in a few of those sea shanties, so they may be getting erased in the near future, but that's a topic for another time.
I chose things purely on whether I liked the spirit of them. They were not filtered for political correctness, I'm sure.
Well, we're not always politically correct here, but just teasing a little bit. But I thought, you know, hey, who put those in there? And now we know. So who are we going to be talking with today? Somebody that's kind of we've had on before but lives far away from here.
I think maybe our third time we've had her over the 15 years.
Well, we're not at 15 years yet, Henry. No, we know.
14.
13. 13. We're about to hit 13. the countdown is on.
We'll get back in. It's Jessica Plum, and she is an environmental movie maker. And she first came on because she was driving a Nissan Leaf before anyone was driving electric cars, and she went camping in her Leaf in the Pacific Northwest, where there are virtually no charging stations. And even now they're thin on the ground, but back then they were really thin on the ground. And she made it all work and enjoyed the process. And then later on, she did a film on the removal of the dam on the Elwha River.
Oh, yeah.
In the Pacific Northwest, and that dam was blocking the salmon from going upstream, and it was a hydroelectric dam. I think maybe it was no longer producing electricity because they had bigger and better dams elsewhere, but they removed that dam and. It made a tremendous mess. It flushed out miles of river silt, but then bounced back, and the salmon started using it for salmon run again, And what happens is they take the nutrients from the ocean where the salmon have been living, and they bring it upstream into the high ground where it's deposited back on the landscape by such things as bear catching the salmon and then eating them and carrying off and doing their business off in the woods and other places.
In the woods,
And that's that land, because it gets so much rainfall, it actually gets all the nutrients washed out of them. And if you don't have those natural cycles working, then the forests just degrade and degrade.
Right.
And it also doesn't help that the forest management system that's being used out there is pretty much 100% for producing the maximum board feet of lumber, as much of the national forest in the United States is. And that frequently means no big trees. Grow those fast-growing small ones and cut them before they get very big. The state of Maine has almost nothing that is big enough for saw timber. Everything goes into pulp paper because they just use the fast-growing, cut it down, plant a fast-growing tree, harvest it when it gets big enough to have done the majority of its really rapid growth and do it all over again.
So are you saying, and we know that the northern, maybe even more than half, 60% of Maine is heavily forested, that there are no stands of old-growth forest in the state of Maine?
I don't know if we're saying that, but the percentage of land, the sawmill industry in Maine has all but died because there's nothing big enough to bother making a board out of.
Hmm. Wow. There you go. Another big change there.
Hmm. Yeah. And so so today we're going to talk about the Tongass, which National Wildlife Park in southeast Alaska, and it's a temperate rainforest or a temperate forest with a lot of rain, and it stores more carbon than the Amazon does on a per acre basis.
Wow.
Which is pretty incredible to believe, and it's an enormous carbon sink. Mm. And anyway, we'll get into the details with Jess Plum when we have her on at 20 after.
Yeah, and that's coming right up. You know what? Well, we're going to go to a bird note here, but not before I acknowledge the folks that have kept this radio show. And we started pretty soon after the debut of this station back on March 9th of 2013. So the show is approaching its 13th anniversary. Yeah. So the folks currently supporting this show and the rest of the station, there are a whole lot more folks than the ones I'm going to read to you right now, but they include relatively new. This will take a while to get to our sort of base level of $150 for underwriters. The Yes We Can Collective. Also, I just passed this restaurant yesterday up in Randolph, Wit and Grit. Solaflect, who we hope are going to renew their underwriting credit soon. Bail, and we need to find out more from Bail. There's a lot of national actions happening this Saturday, and I think some information on that locally. I know there's an event happening, a demonstration happening in Randolph, and I would suspect there's one happening here in South Royalton. You can find out about that by going to bailvt.org. Someone who checks in pretty regularly when I'm around, Tom Wells, longtime supporter, as is Daniel Leibowitz, and the Upper Pass Beer Company. So that's the underwriters, and we're going to also later in the show talk about an event that's happening tonight, and also maybe a little bit about how you can be prepared for some power outages. But right now I'm going to bring Henry down in the mix, and we're going to go to Bird Note. Providing water for birds is the topic on this week's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Wren or robin, finch or chickadee, most birds love a good bath. Bigger birds, too. A Cooper's hawk may stand and splash in a birdbath for half an hour. Bathing helps keep feathers in prime condition. Some birds get the fluids they need from their food, but many birds need a drink at least twice a day. In natural settings, birds may drink or bathe at the shallow rim of a pond or stream, or in puddles. We can recreate this in our built environment by placing bird baths at different heights, including right on the ground. Small birds may visit only shallow bird baths, an inch or two deep. Putting rocks in the bird bath gives birds a place to rest and preen, and keeps insects from drowning. Water is important not only during hot or dry seasons when it's in short supply, but also during the cold season when natural sources may freeze. Water is essential for birds, and supplying clean water for them to drink and bathe in is a great way to help maintain native bird life. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Did you know? Well, thank you very much for that, Michael Stein. So, Henry, this time of year, where are the birds going to have their bath?
Well, it was very interesting. I picked this one out because we have a bird water that the squirrels very much enjoy. They do a lot of drinking there, so it's not just for birds. But it's it's a large dog watering bowl with a thermostatic heater in it that keeps it from freezing. Even in the coldest nights, it had some frost crystals around the edge, but it never really froze in all the way across. And yesterday I was looking out and there was this funny looking pile of feathers at the edge of that looks like a bird, but I couldn't tell it was dead or alive or what it was. And I watched it for a while, and it was a mourning dove with its head tucked under its wing. Mm-hmm. So you were just seeing kind of feathers bristled up in different directions. And it had taken a bath at perhaps 9 degrees above zero.
Mm.
And was drying out.
Yeah, trying to dry out.
and I thought that was quite extraordinary to see. I didn't actually watch it doing it splashing around, but it was definitely went back to working on its feathers and preening itself. So birds have a gland over their tail that produces oils and fat. And they go and massage that with their beak, and they rub that oil and fat into their feathers to stop them from getting brittle and fracturing, to keep them supple.
Yeah. Smart.
You know, the other kinds of things that birds do to bathe is they take dust baths.
Yes.
And they do that mostly in the summer, but that's to get rid of
mites,
unwanted parasites.
Yeah, those mites. Our chickens are pretty good about making little depressions in the dried earth and hunkering down in there. They really like that. Hey, one other little bird note here that I have, and this is we highly recommend this magazine. It's a quarterly. It's called Northern Woodlands, and they carry and the Herald does this. In fact, I'm going to just read part of this from the Herald, the outside story. This piece is written by Colby Gallagher, and she writes about conservation, ecology, and environmental policy. And you can often find her work and a whole lot of great material. I imagine the spring issue of Northern Woodlands is still several weeks away. This is about the winter flicker. She writes, "While many of our region's colorful birds fly south for the cold months, resident woodpeckers offer a reliable contrast to this season's monochrome palette. A pileated woodpecker's blazing crest," I just saw one of those the other day, "and the miniature red cap of a hairy woodpecker brighten the gray and white doldrums. But few avian winter wardrobes match the brilliance of the northern flicker, a mostly migratory bird that every so often toughs out the snow and ice in northern New England. Northern flickers sport a combination of mottled and speckled brown and black plumage. Keep your eye out for them. That camouflages the birds effectively, so look for the eye-catching red nape of their necks and their white behinds. You might also pay close attention when they take flight. Perhaps the most dazzling feature is the lightning yellow underside of their wings and tail. Out west, these feathers are primarily red. There are two recognized subspecies in the U.S., yellow-shafted and red-shafted. So keep your eye out for the winter flicker, this specific one, the northern flicker that has that secret yellow spot. Henry, I don't know if you're still there or you've gone to our phone call. I think he has gone to the phone call, so I'm going to bring this back down, and we will rejoin Henry momentarily. Let's continue with a little bit more of that music from May Erlewine. You listen to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. Type of a conversation, said the ivy to the iris and the river to the sea. Henry, have you rejoined us here on Green Zine?
I have, and I have Jessica Plum with us. So welcome to Green Zine, Jess.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to return, and greetings from the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, welcome back. A little early out there. Let's see, just about a little bit past 8:20, but maybe you're an early riser, Jess.
Well, I can't claim to be a true morning person, but I am definitely starting the day. The sun has only just come up here. We're on the very western edge of the time zone, and so mornings are late this time of year.
Okay, well,
yes,
great to have you back.
You have short daylight hours compared to us, too, this time of year.
Well, like you, we're close to the Canadian border and about as far north as you can get in the United States, so yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always Alaska where you've been visiting.
Very much so.
So just let's get right down to business. And you're, among other things, a film producer. And tell us just a little bit about that, and then we'll dive into your current project.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I have had the pleasure of making documentary or nonfiction film based in the Pacific Northwest for about 20 years now. And over the course of that time, my focus has really been primarily, not entirely, but almost entirely on environmental topics that impact the landscape that I call home. And my interest has been exploring the relationship between people and the waters and lands that sustain us here. And you referenced one of my first major films. I made a feature about the restoration of the Elwha River on the Olympic Peninsula, which at the time was the largest dam removal in the world. And I've never been happier to pass a torch than I am on this one. Of course, the Klamath has now surpassed the Elwha in the river restoration world, which is a wonderful thing. And since then, I have continued to work on a number of different topics that are about the ways our ecosystems are interwoven. Most recently, I finished an hour-long trilogy about the extinction threat facing southern resident killer whales, which are local orcas, and Chinook salmon. And at present, I am working on a new feature film about temperate rainforests. So it's been an amazing journey, and I feel very grateful to be able to tell stories about the places I love. I want to acknowledge I'm originally from New England, however, and I heard you talking about my home state earlier, Maine, where I grew up.
Whereabouts in Maine was that, Jess?
I grew up in Portland, Maine, and I know the coast very well since my family spent a lot of time on a boat.
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
That's great to hear.
There you are.
Yeah.
Linkage with my daughter. Tell us what a temperate rainforest is.
Good place to start.
We could spend a lot of time on Maine.
Right.
Todd and his partner have a place on the Maine coast, and obviously I have extended family there too. But yes, tell us what a temperate rainforest is, and why that that Tongass National Forest is so important.
Absolutely. So first, I think it's important to know that temperate rainforests are actually among the world's rarest ecosystems. Something less than 1% of the planet's land surface actually is known for temperate rainforest, and they exist in both the northern and southern hemisphere, but only in a very kind of narrow band. And these are places where the rainfall combined with the proximity to the ocean, I'm sorry, I hope you're not getting dings from my phone, where the rainfall and I just want to check in and make sure you're not getting text.
We're not hearing
it. Okay.
No, if you can ignore them, we don't hear them.
Great. So back to temperate rainforests. Temperate rainforests exist in these very narrow bands where there's a lot of rainfall, where conditions are cool but not so cold that the growing season is long. And the place that I call home, right here in Washington State on the Olympic Peninsula, is part of the world's largest intact temperate rainforest, or even partially intact temperate rainforest, which stretches from Northern California up through Southeast Alaska. And what that means in terms of what a forest feels like and looks like is that a temperate rainforest can be distinguished by the fact that trees often support other forms of life on the tree. So probably you have experienced somewhere a place where you see a tree dripping with moss or with lichen or supporting whole other species. And that's one of the hallmarks of a temperate rainforest, is that each tree in and of itself then supports this huge diversity of other life. So I had the pleasure years ago of doing a short film in Olympic National Park that was a bioblitz on a single old growth tree. It was a large Douglas fir. And by the time scientists were done climbing that tree that day, they had cataloged well over 100 different species living in that one tree. Temperate rainforest. Yeah.
Just so very, very much in common with what makes the Amazon such a powerful forest is all the different things that are happening within the canopy.
Absolutely. But I would say one thing that many people don't realize compared to the Amazon is that actually temperate rainforests are storing even more carbon. Certainly the Amazon is famous the world over for its lush biodiversity and extraordinary types of forests that are vital to all of Earth's health. Temperate rainforests tend to have longer lived trees. The trees can live, in some cases, over 1,000 years. And what that means is that they are actually holding and storing more carbon, both above ground and below ground, than most ecosystems on Earth. And as I said, they're also vanishingly rare because there's this narrow range of conditions in which they thrive. So, to me, I feel like they are very special ecosystems worthy of our attention, and many people aren't even aware of how important they are to the larger planet.
Are there, just a quick question, are there less temperate rainforest acreage globally now than, let's say, a century or two ago, or are they've been, they're rare, but they're hanging in there, the ones that we have?
They are vanishingly rare, and we have lost them all over the world.
Yeah.
And one reason I'm working on a film right now is that I wanted to bring the loss of temperate rainforest and the risk to remaining temperate rainforest to the attention of the public. And so what I chose to do for my current project was to compare and contrast two ecosystems that have a lot in common. They share the exact same latitude and a similar history, but today look very, very different. And if you were to take off from Ketchikan, Alaska, which is the heart of the Tongass National Forest, and then fly east as a bird or in a plane from a high vantage point, the next place you would land that had the same amount of rainfall, similar conditions to what we see in the North Pacific along our Southeast Alaska coast, is in the North Atlantic, and it's actually the northern British Isles. And on that latitude, you would land right in Glasgow. And I became curious and fascinated by the fact that the northern UK, both Scotland and Ireland, are not known for their forests. In fact, I think most people picture rolling and beautiful open hills and moorlands. And that is what those islands look like today. However, historically, it is not. Historically, the northern UK was known for a vast temperate rainforest from coast to coast in Scotland. And that is but one of the places on the planet where that landscape has been truly transformed, lost. There was also a much more extensive temperate rainforest in southern Chile. There are other parts of the world that have supported this type of ecosystem where logging and other land use practices have reduced it to close to nothing. So we have lost the vast majority of temperate rainforest that did exist to human use at this point.
So what are the implications for the Earth in general to have that loss take place?
Well, because these rainforests are known for their capacity to sequester a huge amount of carbon, the global implication, of course, is that we are losing the opportunity or losing the actual sequestered carbon in these landscapes. But that's but one of the functions. And I think it's important to look at the forests as more than just carbon sinks, which they are. They are also sites of biodiversity. And one of the things that I like to highlight in my films is that I'm really interested in talking about the relationship between people and place. And temperate rainforests have also given rise to some remarkable cultures and examples of sustainable living in the forest and with the forest. And in Southeast Alaska, that is a place where I think it's important to understand that here in the United States, we do have communities that are living largely off the land and waters they call home. And sustainably, thanks to the bounty that's provided by temperate rainforest landscapes. So from my perspective, the role that these forests play on Earth is both an environmental role and a cultural role. They have vital roles to play in both arenas.
Can you tell us more about the people that you you met in the Tongass area? I gather you've spent more time there than you have in Scotland. Scotland's been other people's projects, maybe more than yours.
Well,
I
have spent time in both over the past year because I have been really interested in trying to understand both landscapes in their current state. I would say that for those who haven't had the chance to experience Southeast Alaska in the United States, it's a truly remarkable part of our country. And I spent a good bit of July there this summer. And for context, I think it's important to understand that we're talking about a region that, first of all, is overwhelmingly public land, most of it's national forest, some of it's state land, and then a large amount of it is the parts that are private, some are owned by tribal corporations, a separate system from the reservation system in the lower 48. The vast majority of communities in Southeast Alaska are not connected to any other part of the country by road. In many places, there are also not even direct connections by air. And so these are communities that are connected by water, by the ferry system, by boats, and sometimes by very small planes. The population of indigenous people in Southeast Alaska is among the largest percentage in the country. And I had the huge pleasure of spending a good bit of my summer both with Haida communities and with Tlingit communities, who are both present in Southeast Alaska and play a vital role culturally and in other ways in the whole region. So this summer, I decided to focus first and foremost, since I was fortunate to have access to a research boat for a couple of weeks, on this connection between people and the forest. And we did some exceptional things. One of those was to document and bear witness to the first totem pole raising in Wrangell, Alaska, in close to four decades. And I felt it was really important to be there for that event because for those who are unfamiliar, totem poles are perhaps the most direct demonstration of culture entwined with old growth trees. They are essentially stories carved into a tree and put up with the work of an entire community to help tell the story of that community. And it's become much harder for carvers who practice that tradition because the huge old growth trees are reduced by logging. And it was incredible to watch both Tlingit and Haida communities come together to do that this summer. I also was, we actually acted as a support boat for one of the communities that came to participate from Prince of Wales Island because they chose to come by dugout canoe, another way in which life in Southeast Alaska is inseparable from large, remarkable old growth trees. And so we were a sport craft for a whole community that arrived in Wrangell. Our canoe. So that's just a little glimpse into how we spent the summer learning about culture in a temperate rainforest.
And I guess the other side of this cultural connection to old growth is the commodification of our natural resources. Can you talk some about that?
Please, yes. Thank you for bringing that up. So one of the reasons that I felt it was important to help talk about this vital cultural connection is that the Tongass National Forest, and to be clear, the bulk of the land is in national forest, not in the protection of, say, a national park. The national forest is now among our most threatened remaining temperate rainforests on Earth. It has for a long time been commodified because these large trees in particular, especially red cedar, but all of the old growth large scale trees are hugely valuable. They're valuable to not just the United States, but have been bought in great numbers from other parts of the world too, especially China and Japan. And over the last five decades, Southeast Alaska has seen a good deal of logging, both in the national forest and in land held by other parties. There was a recognition over the past 20 years that the rate of logging was no longer sustainable and that the region, which depends upon fishing and tourism, needed to maintain some of these forests to support those other industries economically, that logging was actually not, for the country, a true money-making business. It was for some of the companies that were practicing it, but a lot of that work was supported especially by road building by the federal government. Over the last couple of decades, there has been an effort that was affirmed by the Biden administration to uphold a roadless rule for large swaths of the Tongass National Forest. And that roadless rule essentially took large chunks of national forest out of the realm of development and future logging, because roads are required essentially to access that timber. And there are very few roads, period, in Southeast Alaska. That roadless rule in its current form is in the process of being overturned by the Trump administration. And it is hard for me to overstate what an enormous impact that will have across Southeast Alaska, where the vast majority of the land is national forest. And it theoretically opens up over 9 million acres of currently forested land to logging and other forms of development. The commodification of those trees has already had a huge impact. And when Southeast Alaskans of all backgrounds are asked about their opinion on this subject, at this point, 96% of the comments coming back to the federal government are, we don't want to rescind the roadless rule. We want to keep it in place because we depend on the remaining intact forests to support the things our region is known for and depends on economically. But the pressure on those trees is enormous. And one of the reasons I'm working on a film right now is I fear we will start to lose swaths of the Tongass National Forest again soon.
Yeah, that would be a disaster. Quick question on the subject of potential logging, and we have spoken with, trying to think of his name right now, Chris Gish, here in the East about this roadless bill that seems to be, I guess it was passed then. It's officially been passed by the Congress?
It's officially, well, the roadless rule that was in place,
yeah,
impacting national forests across the entire country, including your part of the country, was officially rescinded in June. Mm-hmm. of 2025. However, there's still a process playing out that will continue to play out in 2026. And I encourage everyone who cares about forests to watch closely. And that is that the next step is that the federal government is required to present a draft EIS or environmental impact statement about what it will mean for our national forests to formally repeal that protection. And I expect, many of us expect, that EIS will come out at some point this spring. And there will be one more brief window, because they have been trying to fast-track the process as quickly as possible within the existing procedures. There may be a comment window as long as perhaps a month where Americans can weigh in on the environmental impact of rescinding the roadless rule that has been in place for the better part of 20 years for many of our national forests. And I can't urge you strongly enough to weigh in if and when that comment window reopens.
All right, we will monitor that. So, just to finish this thread on, is there a lot of pressure from logging companies? I mean, are they just chomping at the bit to jump right in there? Because it seems like it'll be
You know, that's a good question and an odd one for Southeast Alaska. The truth is that there is not from local logging companies. This pressure is coming largely from outside. Of the mills that existed in Southeast Alaska that had their heyday in kind of the 70s, 80s, 90s, literally just one mill remains on the ground in the region, I believe employing less than 50 people. And indeed, that mill continues to ask the federal government for access to old growth because they were providing and continue to provide some specialty wood products. However, from what I've seen and what I've heard, even from people who participated in the logging industry in Southeast Alaska up through the 90s, the most accessible forest for logging and the most affordable, by in essence, potential areas for logging have already been accessed and cut. And so there is not so much pressure on the ground from Southeast Alaskans. That pressure is coming more broadly from outside, bigger corporations who see an opportunity. Those who actually know the logging industry well on the ground in Southeast Alaska have noted again and again that it is not an easy place to do business, precisely because there are so few roads and access is so difficult. So it is a strange conundrum where the federal government is seeking to open lands for profit that actually don't bring profit back to the government or to necessarily the people in the region where the cutting is occurring. And that is the dilemma.
Henry?
Commodification, onward.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know if you want to take a moment and talk about the contrast with Scotland and Northern England and what the lack of forest has meant for them as a contrast and compare.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And before I dive in, I should also say that one of the things that drew me to Scotland and continues to draw me to Scotland is some very positive and ambitious work in the realm of rewilding. And I've been following a couple of projects that are truly inspiring, led by communities that are eager to try to reclaim some of the long-lost landscapes that are hard to envision there. So that said, I think one of the direct comparisons between these two places concerns the impact of forest loss on the rest of the ecological community. And many people are surprised to realize that in, you know, centuries past, one of the things that the Northern UK really shared with the Pacific Northwest was that we're both salmon nations. We were both places where salmon functioned as keystone species. And, you know, here in the Northwest, especially in Alaska, but certainly the whole Pacific coast, it's hard to imagine this part of the world without its salmon, either ecologically or culturally. In Scotland and in the northern UK, there's still a smattering of wild salmon, but because salmon are fundamentally, although they're seen as ocean creatures, they depend on forests. They're forest animals. They're born and die in the upper watersheds of shaded creeks, and that has made it very tough for them to thrive in an environment without forest. And it's made them rare enough that now to catch a wild salmon in the UK is a privilege for the very elite. You can pay a great deal of money for that privilege. From the vantage point of someone living in Alaska or even, you know, anywhere in the Pacific Northwest, that's the definition of total loss, losing the resources that exist because of the forest ecosystem. And so that's one big change. And I think when we look at those landscapes, they are landscapes that are still, and I'm speaking of the northern UK, they're beautiful. They're beautiful and in ways still very, very wild. But it is hard to unsee now how the loss of forest cover has also cost those landscapes, you know, a huge percentage of their bird population. Many other species, and more simply, a relationship that existed between people and forest that now feels remote. And that's part of what the communities engaged in rewilding are trying to reclaim. I think if you want to stop and think for a moment about how many scenes written by Shakespeare, how many plays are set in the forest? And where are those landscapes now? Indeed, temperate rainforests are having a moment in the narrative film world. For those of you who've seen Hamnet, there are beautiful scenes shot in a tiny remaining scrap of temperate rainforest in that film about Shakespeare's early life in the writing of Hamlet. So I think that when you lose forest, you lose not only ecological function in a whole range of ways, which then affects river systems, affects other species, it also affects how people live on and relate to the land.
This is not probably your territory completely, but as a member of the Vermont Healthy Soils Coalition, it's a focus point for me. Are you aware of the loss of soil in Scotland due to the deforestation? I know in Vermont, in Vermont, when it was largely forested when the Europeans arrived, and they defoliated the place partly to be able to plow and graze animals, but much of the topsoil on the hillsides landed up in the valleys during that process. Steep terrain here.
Yes, indeed. I spent a totally fascinating day while I was in Scotland this past June with a scientist whose work primarily focuses on salmon restoration, but was more broadly just speaking about the function of rivers and watersheds. And yes, indeed, when trees are stripped off the landscape, that has an impact on the soil and on runoff and how all of that then, how all of those soils function. I don't consider myself an expert on that. There was also a habit, in addition to deforestation across the UK, of draining peatlands, which is a separate and vital soil question. Another restoration goal that's underway in a lot of places in the UK. But I'm glad you bring up soil, because soil is the base of this whole story. And when we talk about carbon sequestration and the capacity of an ecosystem to sequester carbon, as you know very well, Henry, you're an expert on this, the soil is where much of that is held. And that is equally true in a forest landscape.
Yeah. Okay. What do you think, Todd? Should we wrap this up and cover some of the upcoming events that we have locally?
And it's been a great discussion. And Jess Plum, I'm looking forward to Henry sent me a couple links to the film and your previous films. And I did recognize the distributor, Bullfrog Productions. I think the radio station has gotten a film from them in the past, and maybe we'll be able to present one of your films to, a part of our community here in Vermont in the future. Amazing work.
Fantastic.
Yeah, amazing work that you're doing, and I really appreciate you joining us and discussing it and some areas that we're not all that familiar with. I don't know if I'll ever make it out to the Tongass or to Northern Scotland, but thanks for coming on Green Zine this week.
Well, it's a pleasure to share, and please know a part of my heart is in Vermont, in part because my daughter is now studying there at the University of Vermont in Burlington. So I have a lot of appreciation for your state as well right now, and thanks for having me.
And your daughter's been helping you on this film, hasn't she?
She has indeed. She has been absolutely invaluable to the project. She is a certified drone pilot, and her work can be seen both on the website and in the current trailer. So I'm really proud of her, and she's doing good environmental studies work in your state. So thank you to all of the opportunities that are available there as well.
Great.
So I have posted in our notes a link to that to those past work that you've done, and also to the trailer for that film coming up, which is quite a beautiful trailer.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for having me, and hopefully my daughter Zia and her friends will get to see some more of this work through your programming over time. And I really appreciate you including these stories from far beyond Vermont. And enjoy the white winter that you're having there.
We will.
In the cold.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Have a great day, Jess.
Thanks so much. Great to have you on. Bye-bye.
It's been my pleasure. Bye.
All right, Henry, I'm just briefly going to refer people to the current issue of 7 Days, which just came out yesterday, and they can find this story on page 40. We started the show with seeds from May Erlewine, and this was inspired by a story of a new seed distributor based in Northfield, which is not very far from here. I'm just going to jump down here to Homecoming Seeds is the name of the business, and the founder is Charlie Watt. He launched his catalog. I mean, this is really recent. Just getting started. Only a week or two ago, on January 17th, on the 19th, he started packing the first orders to ship around Vermont and to customers in Jersey, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. He grows roughly 80% of the new company's open pollinated vegetable, flower, and herb seed stock himself at Fly Tree Farm in Northfield. So possible future springtime guest here on Green Zine. He lives there with his wife Maddie and daughter Fia. The rest is grown locally at farms he contracts with, such as Small Axe Farm in Barnett. Once again, you can get a glimpse of what's going on at his farm and maybe think about some seeds as we get closer to spring. This story in 7 days this week on, it's written by Jordan Berry. Very interesting story there. Henry, one other thing, and then I'm going to toss it back to you. Tonight at 6 p.m., just up the road here, about a mile up north on 14 at the Royalton Academy building, a special roundtable. Try to envision a two-week power outage. The grid going down. Come listen tonight and brainstorm with local and regional experts to come up with some strategies. In truth, most of us will be on our own. But with some preparation and arrangements ahead of time, we can be self-sufficient for an extended period of time. The emergency services coordinators for both Royalton and Tunbridge will be there. Somebody coming down from Montpelier. Going to be a very interesting discussion. And I'm going to bring up Balcony Solar during that discussion, Henry. That could be if you wired into a battery, and we know that that legislation is moving forward pretty well so far under the Golden Dome. Maybe that could be a source of backup power during an outage. Back to you.
Yes, certainly with batteries it would be. And I put a note in the notes for the show for the most recent Volts podcast, which is why is solar panels on the roof so expensive in Vermont or in the U.S. in general, in fact, compared to Australia. We're literally three times the price. And that episode of Volts gets into the nitty-gritty of all of the holdups that happen in the United States when you want to put solar on your roof, and how to maybe clear those away. So that's along with Balcony Solar. I'm certainly enjoying my experience with having put up some solar panels and am using it to power things not associated with the grid, cover part of my house. And I'm looking forward to making better and better use of that solar energy coming in for free. And I didn't have to go through all the regulatory processes that tend to make it expensive for an installer to do those things, because it was nothing to do with the grid. And upcoming, Todd mentioned that we have Bail and the Resistance Hub, and Wednesday, February 4th, from 6 p.m. to 7:30, they will be an opportunity to stand up and be counted, bring a sign or not, and go to the bridge between leading into South Royalton. And resistance does a lot, and that's part of what the film that we've just been hearing about is about, people pushing back and making things happen.
Yeah, and I noted on the music show a little bit earlier today the number of letters to the editor in the Herald that are definitely saying that that type of criticism, resistance, trying to retain democratic principles and the constitutional ethos that this country was founded on, very important. Right now, we're listening to part of a soundtrack. This is a waltz here, Henry. Democracy Waltz Reprise from Jonas Strick, part of the soundtrack to a very fine film called Democracy Noir, a Hungarian-made film, and I would highly recommend it. People can look it up. Apparently, it's available at a rather nominal fee online. Once again, it's called Democracy Noir. A lot of resistance against the autocracy of Viktor Orban over in Hungary. On behalf of the radio station WFVR-LP South Royalton and this show, Green Zine, we do want to thank Solaflect, Bail, Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. Henry, any final thoughts as we move into the final 30 seconds of the show?
Well, I'm actually enjoying feeling real winter, even though it's cold and you can grumble about the cold. But I appreciate that winter can be real still. I hope it continues to be able to have its moments.
Right. Hey, stay tuned for Democracy Now! And thanks for joining us here on WFVR.